Welcome to episode 5 of Indestructible, Indestructible, Latin America with Rodrigo Acuña. This podcast is a collaborative effort between myself and Alborada, an independent voice on Latin American politics, media and culture based in the United Kingdom. I'm a contributing editor of Alborada and am based in Sydney, Australia. In this episode, I speak with Camila Escalante, who is a journalist and correspondent reporting on the ground in Latin America. Having previously worked for the pan-Latin American television channel Telesur, Camila now reports for Quechuan News, which is the English language service of Radio Quechuan Coca, the official outlet of 6 farmers' trade unions of the Tropico of Cochabamba, Bolivia. Quechuan News was created in May 2019 at the height of the popular struggle against the US-backed coup, as social movements demanded that their voices be heard internationally. Bolivia, for those of you who may be unaware, is one of the most unionized countries in the world. As always, thanks to those of you who are supporting us on Patreon and to those sharing the episodes on social media. See the program's notes for all the relevant social media addresses. If you'd like to support this podcast, please visit www.patreon.com/indestructiblepod. As an independent media project, all financial support is greatly appreciated. Patrons get exclusive access to full transcripts for all the podcast episodes, and we have more in store over the coming months. More information on all the episodes can be found at www.alborada.net/indestructible. I now leave you with episode 5 of Indestructible, Indestructible, my conversation with Camila Escalante. So, Camila, I'd like to begin my first question, which is, why a career in journalism and how did you end up as a reporter for Quechuan News? I understand you previously worked for the pan-Latin American channel Telesur and that you currently live in a remote village in the tropics of Cochabamba, Bolivia.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I studied political science in university, and I think that was more, you know, what I thought was useful to me is learning about political systems. Of course, when possible, learning about the history of Latin America, Latin American history, political theory, as it relates to Latin America. And I think that I always thought that I was going to do a graduate degree and study more of Latin American history, study more about some of the historical struggles of indigenous peoples, the social movements here in Latin America. And of course, I grew up in the global north and I got involved with, different organizing there. But, you know, I found out that I had a real strength and connection and interest with the current struggles in Latin America. And of course, my strength was that, you know, understanding a whole nother world, the Spanish-speaking world, being able to try kind of, translate what was going on here to other people in the global north. And, you know, I had always felt that this was my home, that Latin America was my home, even though I didn't have the privilege of being able to grow up here because of course, all of our histories that brought us to the global north, that took us away from our countries. And so, I had the opportunity to study with the Landless Workers Movement, MST in Brazil at their political formation school in the rural area of Sao Paulo. And after the course that I took there, which was a political education for political educators course, I didn't want to go back to the North. And I stayed in Brazil a little longer and was able to travel around. And I think, you know, I just was fortunate enough to have someone tell me, who was then the director of Telesur English, to apply at Telesur English and come to Quito. And so I did that. And it really fit in with what I wanted to do. I did want to, you know, find some way of, transmitting the information I had, you know, when I was in undergrad and through my own personal research and studies, I was really interested in, you know, what I had learned about later on in life, not as a child. You know, as when I was younger, I learned a lot about, you know, the struggles in Latin America and the Central America, where my family's from, specifically in El Salvador. And the older I got and the more I spoke to people like yourself, Rodrigo, and people like Pablo Navarrete, of course, I didn't speak to you guys, but I spoke to other people who were from South America and other parts of the region, only to find out that the same processes and the same, you know, similar situations of dictatorships and struggles for democracy and, you know, civil conflicts and things like this have happened in so many of our countries with so many parallel histories. And so I learned more and more about that as I got older. And this was just perfect for me. You know, Telestor English was kind of everything I wanted to do, which was, you know, put everything together, but also, you know, establish these facts, represent them to the world in English, because there's so many of us who are all, you know, spread all throughout the world. So, you know, there at Telestor, I was able to work in a number of different capacities, you know, doing exactly that, bringing those stories about what's going on to the forefront and kind of just simplifying that coverage and just, you know, making it more available to people, you know, especially in the US, the UK, Canada, Australia, and other parts of Western Europe, of course. And so that's kind of what we wanted to do here. At Calcestro News, but we wanted to focus on something more specific, you know, more specific processes, which of course, you know, the social movements here in Bolivia and the process that that took place here that led to the foundation of the MAS, that led to the struggles against the DEA, and that led to, you know, the resistance to the coup and the restoration of democracy. We thought that was very important to highlight in the similar fashion as other outlets and journalists have been able to successfully and very well highlight things in Venezuela and other countries. We always saw that this was kind of a missing piece and that we wanted to, you know, obviously report from Latin America on a whole and tie all of these stories and, you know, all of this information together, but have a very specific focus and be rooted in one specific place. And of course, because of all of the violence and instability in El Salvador, I haven't really had the opportunity to live there. You know, my family has a lot of concerns about being there. And so it's always been my hope that I would be able to establish some media there and report there on the ground, but hasn't really been possible. There continue to be a lot of issues there in general. So this has just been a wonderful place to set up an outlet and have somewhere to start from and to be rooted, but to also be able to expand, of course.
Mm-hmm. And you say the Global North, you grew up specifically in the United States or in Canada?
In Arizona.
Mm-hmm. In Arizona, okay. Now, in 2005, headed by the government of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, and with the financial support of several Latin American countries, the pan-Latin American news channel Telesur was established. As its own promotion often reminds its audience, the purpose of Telesur is to provide news and a perspective from the South. Now, since its establishment, Telesur has broken some major stories in Latin America and also seen some of its journalists harassed by state authorities in some countries. Could you tell our audience a little about the stories you covered with Telesur?
Yeah, I mean, Telesur has, from its outset, like you said, in the early 2000s, has covered some extremely important stories. And some of the most important stories that we've covered, you know, people aren't exactly doing backflips and somersaults over, but, you know, it's just constantly covering these important developments in Cuba, you know, bringing to the English-speaking world, you know, the ways in which climate change has affected the Caribbean and also, you know, the Caribbean, Latin America, you know, just so many different stories, the, you know, the coup in Honduras, just have been, they wouldn't have been able to be covered as thoroughly as they were through any other network, although there are some other networks that are, you know, supposed to be international as well. But since the time that I've been or that I was at Telus UR. Of course, in the most recent years, I was able to focus on Bolivia, but I also had the opportunity of covering Ecuador on the ground and the indigenous movement uprising there that was led primarily by CONAIE. This is an indigenous movement that is, from throughout the country, all of the regions, the Amazon, the highlands, the coast, and that was, extremely important. But in addition to that, there were a lot of other worker struggles and, protests and other resistance to Lenin Moreno's neoliberalization of the country during his 4 years, where he basically turned his back on the citizens' revolution and the whole process and the achievements under Rafael Correa, his predecessor, who essentially brought him to that electoral victory in 2017. I've also, had the privilege of, living for short periods, but in Venezuela and in Havana, in Caracas and Havana, and working for Telus UR there. And, of course, with everything that's gone on with the U.S. blockade on Cuba, the U.S. blockade and, what is unilateral course of measures against Venezuela, it's been very important to cover that and to, try to help people understand why we're saying sanctions are war, why sanctions are, criminal, and why they're not, just directed towards and affecting certain people within the government, that this is, a complete lie, that, it only causes damage financially or otherwise, or impedes people's ability to travel in terms of the authorities. This is absolutely untrue. It actually, as we know, in the cases of Venezuela, Cuba, and all other sanctioned countries, it makes it more difficult for people and governments to be able to get their hands on medicine, food, and other basic necessities. So this is something that, we worked really hard to be able to cover in Telus UR, both in English and Spanish.
Mm-hmm. Now, in recent years, Latin America has experienced a series of US-backed coup d'etats or attempted coups. We have the case of the violent overthrow of President Manuel Zelaya in Honduras in 2009, the attempted coup against President Rafael Correa in Ecuador in 2010, the highly questionable removal in 2012 by the Senate of the President of Paraguay, Fernando Lugo, and in 2016, in another highly questionable action by the country's Senate, this time in Brazil, the removal of President Dilma Rousseff of the Workers' Party. And more recently, the overthrow of Bolivia's President Evo Morales by the military and a right-wing racist Christian fundamentalist by the name of Jenny Añez Chavez, who some have highlighted was Latin America's first female dictator. Do you think media outlets like Telesur and Catsuan News have had an impact in documenting and exposing these foreign-backed coup d'etats in real time?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's been the magic formula. And I think that's why these outlets have been so successful. There are a number of outlets in Venezuela, for example, also in Argentina and other countries where, are based on a formula model, which is websites. They put out articles, they put out recorded interview programs and things like that, with analysis, sometimes with statistical analysis in the case of, SALAG. We have all these really important institutions and outlets, but Telus UR specifically, and similarly Casastro News, what we've wanted to do is put out the very necessary, basic, essential information right away. So, in the case of Bolivia, it was just very important to have Freddy Morales, who's, our colleague in La Paz and the team, out on the ground, in the central plaza, Plaza Murillo, documenting for us, telling us what was going on when these opposition lawmakers and Senator Jeanine Añez was going in to swear herself in, and people were being prohibited from entering the building. The coup-aligned The pro-coup military and police were forbidding people from entering the area, even people who were accredited because they're actual mass lawmakers and stuff like that. This is very important information, and we need to have some sort of, we need to have some sort of outlet with the capacity to put out this crucial information very quickly. And at different times during the Bolivia coup, we weren't on the ground necessarily. Myself, I might have been in Quito or in Havana or somewhere else when a lot of these things were going on, but we were trying to, you know, take information from our contributors, collaborators, and other community outlets, and put that information out in English as soon as possible to be able to let people know what was going on. And this is something we're continuing to do now. It's just translating things that allows people to, you know, decipher for themselves, decide what's going on based on, you know, listening to a translated speech with subtitles. This is something that doesn't really happen in real time. We've had a lot of outlets, some of these, you know, those outlets that are kind of receiving NGO money, for example, or I'm not really sure. There's a whole variety of, you know, what call themselves independent or whatnot, outlets that focus on Latin America or sometimes a number of issues, but Latin America might be a region part of it. But we want, at Calsashua News, we specifically aim to, you know, dedicate the whole of our coverage to Latin America specifically, which is, you know, a lot narrower than what Telesur does. Telesur, of course, has overseas correspondents and contributors and offices, but we want to focus small, start local, and, you know, let people know this, like, very basic information. Another example is that we translated a speech made by Pedro Castillo, the candidate in this Sunday's election in Peru, just so that people can know the way he speaks, the things he says. Of course, in his, you know, speech of, let's say, 15, 20 minutes, he doesn't name every single one of his proposals or details on those. He's not elaborating on everything. But I think it's really important for people in the English-speaking world, whether they be part of the Peruvian diaspora or whether they just be other Latin American people or just English-speaking people who want to know what's going on in Latin America, to have a taste of what's going on here through just that simple act of translating things, of cutting clips and videos, and, you know, doing these short articles. And so this has been key, and this is something we want to build on, and we want to be able to increase our capacity to do this in more countries, of course.
Mm-hmm. Now, focusing on specifically on Bolivia, which is the country that you cover and that you're based in, I'm interested in hearing your perspective on the 2019 US-backed coup against President Evo Morales. What is your take on those events and where things stand now, given that MAS, the party that was overthrown, has returned to power? Maybe if you can explain to our audience why there was a coup to begin with.
Yeah, so of course, what we have said all along and what the social movements and the movement towards socialism and the unions that make up that governing party have said all along was that this coup was a number of opposition forces of a very, you know, what has and, you know, for years and years and continues to be now a very fragmented, disjointed opposition, but they came together with the aims of, you know, in imposing a system of neoliberalism here, of absolutely tearing to shreds the socialist economic policies that were implemented under Evo Morales and Luis Arce as economy minister for the past 14 years. They wanted to, you know, privatize, sell off natural resources, you know, dismantle nationalized countries and state industries. And of course, as Evo Morales continues to say, it becomes clearer and clearer as we encounter more evidence that these people were doing it all for personal gain. And of course, that's what brought them all to the table together to decide to undergo these attacks on the mass government together. And of course, for so many reasons, it didn't last more than 12 months because of the, you know, the strength and the depth of the organized bases here, which, you know, they probably could have taken the government out of power by marching to the palace. I mean, that's just the sheer number of people they had. But I think, you know, from above, there were a lot of leaders who were saying, we can take back power through the ballot box, and it'll just prove to everyone that this whole thing was a giant lie, that there was no fraud, as the OAS had suggested, and as the EU and the Catholic Church and the coup leaders all argued that was, you know, totally just false. And so, you know, that's the way they went about recovering democracy. But I think that in a lot of ways, if you are, you know, familiar with the April 2002 coup in Venezuela against Hugo Chavez, if you have followed, you know, any one of these destabilization attempts or coups in Latin America over the past several decades, you'll see that there are a lot of similarities between all of these. And so the difference is now that we were trying to, as we spoke about earlier, report on these acts in real time and try to, you know, explain what's going on as these things happen. And I think that the case of Bolivia has become a case that so many people now have become familiar with and now understand all of the different things that happen in ways that they didn't have that sort of understandings about, you know, other coups and things that have happened throughout Latin America in recent history. And I think this is really important because, you know, understanding how these things happen, this is an ongoing process, of course, but understanding the ways in which certain parties of the opposition, certain, you know, political actors of the opposition receive funding from NGOs, receive funding from the U.S. State Department indirectly through agencies, and, you know, the kind of interests that they represent is the same. This is the same kind of scenario that we're seeing in other countries as well, namely Venezuela and Nicaragua and Cuba right now. And to, you know, in different ways, in Mexico and Argentina as well, and also in Brazil, you know, there's going to be a lot of people who will be making all sorts of outlandish claims about the PT government and about Lula's government in order to, you know, try to confuse people so that to lessen his chances of winning in Brazil's next election. So, you know, this, so I think that what happened in Bolivia was extremely unique and important because of how quickly the social movements were able to mobilize and militantly resist the coup until they were able to restore power. But in so many other ways, it was not, exceptional in that we've seen this happen so many other times. The difference now is that we are able to more clearly understand the different signs, the different steps these actors that are aligned with Washington are taking. And hopefully we can help people more easily identify this process so that it's thwarted before it succeeds again in another country. Mm.
The opposition in Venezuela has long claimed that were they to take power, they would defund the Pan Latin American News Network, Telesur. My understanding is that when right-wing governments have come to power in other Latin American countries, they have done that or they have commenced to remove funds from Telesur and create obstacles for the media organization. What do you think is the future for such an interesting experiment? Because Telesur has sort of become, for many Latin Americans, the sort of the counterpoint to CNN, you know, all of the northern-based media outlets.
Yeah, I think that telestore needs to be strengthened. From the very outset, you know, it began as a Spanish, like you said, pan-Latin American outlet with some funding and support and, you know, permissions to air on different channels and providers throughout Latin America. And, you know, some of those different, some of that support, like you said, dwindled under certain governments like Mauricio Macri in Argentina. But I think it's very important that specifically in Spanish, that there's nothing else like it, although there's some very good coverage that exists on RT in Espanol and then Hispan TV. And there's some other, there are some other, you know, networks or programs that reach international audiences, but Telesur is by far the most important. And so I think it really needs to, you know, this is something that, as, you know, with every leftist government or leftist party that takes power in different countries, we really need to, you know, see the strengthening of this outlet and growth and expansion, really, because it is, you know, just absolutely crucial. I think that the reason why, you know, Guaido's friends in Miami and Washington have specifically targeted Telesur is because just the spectacular amount of reach it gets. Even if people don't receive Telesur on their television because of where they live or because of the cable provider they have, you know, the information is all over social media, and, you know, it has been just absolutely invaluable. So I think that that is precisely why, despite that the largest media outlets in just about the majority of countries of Latin America are controlled by the right wing, are aligned with right wing parties, controlled by the oligarchy, and, you know, backed by multinationals to spread fear, to spread anti-communist ideas, to spread anti-socialist ideas and false information, despite that wall of lies and, you know, neoliberal right-wing propaganda, Telesur and outlets like Telesur have still gotten through to people. And so I think this is incredibly important. And so I think that, you know, our job specifically at Casa News, and of course, the kind of work that you guys do at Alvarada, and, you know, kind of your own independent writing and things and reporting, is really important for the English speaking world, because what we're doing is, you know, what Telesur is doing, but in English, to reach wider audiences.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the drug trade in Latin America and US foreign policy. If we take a cursory look at the mainstream media, four countries constantly come up: Colombia, Honduras, Mexico, and Venezuela. While reports of corrupt officials from all countries at times do surface, if we are to believe the narrative from the mainstream media and statements from the White House, from the Obama administration through to the Trump and now Biden administration, it is Venezuela, which is the country that has been labeled a narco state, with Washington imposing sanctions on numerous high-ranking Venezuelan government officials. Should we believe Washington and much of the mainstream media's version of events, or should we be focusing more on other countries like Colombia?
Yeah, for a long time I've been saying, and we've been saying at Telesur, and now, of course, we're trying to cover it at Casa Sur News, that it's extremely important to follow the events in Colombia, because outside and beyond, and long before this national strike and these massive ongoing mobilizations, there has been an absolutely brutal conflict, huge displacement internally, and displacement in terms of Colombians having to go live in all neighboring countries, Ecuador, Venezuela, and of course, US and Canada and the UK and everywhere else. And, you know, during this whole discussion, where now we're beginning to see larger outlets, corporate media begin to speak about the protests because it's absolutely impossible to ignore. They're still speaking about it in terms of like, and framing it as if it were a one-off thing, that all of a sudden, you know, every country takes a turn protesting, you know, in every country we're going to see, you know, some citizen unrest, especially because people are so angry because of the effects that the lockdown that stemmed from COVID have had on the people and the economy, and people have taken a hit. I mean, this is simply the wrong way of framing what's going on. What's going on in Colombia is very different from what's going on anywhere else. It's similar in that, you know, people are really living through difficult times under neoliberal regimes, but it's very different in that we have entire regions and territories of the country that are absolutely dominated and run by paramilitaries, by illegal narco trafficking groups that are aided by the Colombian government, as well as the DEA and the US military, which has unrestricted access to numerous bases in Colombia, if not all of Colombian soil. And so the, you know, just last year, probably in June, exactly a year ago this week, I would say, we found out that the US Army was going to send troops to train people in Colombia. And it was going to be a new special task force or special forces that were going to come. And it was actually, to some extent, temporarily at least, stifled by the Colombian Senate. Opposition senators said absolutely no, like, we're literally surrendering the whole of our armed forces and sovereignty to another military. But so what happened was that in the end, they allowed, you know, military advisors, perhaps you guys know more about this than I do, but they were able to come into Colombia and operate just the same. So the difference was that they weren't allowing troops, you know, additional troops to come into Colombia. But we're talking about a country that is being advised militarily, whose you know, anti-drug strategy has been devised by the United States for over two decades, and has had this super close partnership. It's unbelievable that any media can go and report on what's going on in Colombia without consideration of the billions of dollars in financing that the Colombian government and security forces have, and financing and resources that Colombia's, you know, security forces have received from the United States government. And it's done in plain sight. And so it's, you know, we're seeing that the United States is a massive security state and lots of huge, you know, defense budget, and that this highly equipped military is coming and providing all the resources for a smaller country, a smaller economy, a smaller military, and arming them, then what is the outcome? Like, what is the reason why they're doing that, and what has been the outcome should be the question of all media outlets, news editors, and journalists in the United States. People should be investigating what you know, comparing what the situation in Colombia was before, at the height of the conflict, and how things are now. Have things really improved? What we know is that Colombia saw a record number of massacres and killings of social leaders, and of course, signers of the peace agreement continue to be killed. And so what is the answer for that? I mean, it doesn't seem like anybody who isn't very small alternative media is asking these questions. So it's just absolutely unbelievable. With all that's going on and all of the killings of protesters and young people, many of which, even in the protests, which are national and they're urban and rural, they're everywhere. Many of the people who continue to be affected by by police brutality and repression have been killed, have been young Indigenous and Afro-descendant Colombians. And even, you know, with all of this happening, it's just the Colombian government, Iván Duque and others within the government are actually going on and doing these Zoom panels and meetings with, you know, the former director of USAID, who now is the director of the Wilson Center. They're doing all of these, you know, different events with all these sort of, let's say, right wing, I don't even know what they are, think tanks, agencies, and just spreading absolute lies about what's going on there. And nobody's, you know, asking a single question in the US with the exception of a small handful of independent journalists. So I think it's really important that we focus on answering these questions. And it's just absolutely the case that given the experience of, you know, Bolivia, you know, foremost Bolivia, that, you know, when you get rid of US forces in the country and take a hold of your own anti-drug policy, you know, that was when they were able to begin to eradicate the overproduction of coke crops in a process which is ongoing, but which has been extremely successful only because the social movements here in this region specifically fought the DEA and kicked it out of the territory.
Mm-hmm. Let's recall as well that the former president Alvaro Uribe, who was in power in Colombia for close to a decade or over a decade, he himself in the early 1990s, according to U.S. intelligence, was considered a close personal friend of Pablo Escobar. And I think it's interesting that there always seems to be far more high-ranking government officials in both Colombia and Honduras that are connected to the drug trade. But this information is only, it only makes the pages of the New York Times when it sort of becomes absolutely overwhelming. And you know, there's journalists and members, you know, minority members of Congress screaming, you know, let's take a look at these people's activities. Camila, I'd like to take the conversation towards a more personal direction. Like most people, I generally reserve my personal and family life to myself. At times, though, I have publicly spoken about my family and how my father was tortured for close to 2 months by several state agencies during the US-backed Pinochet military regime in Chile in the mid-1970s. If you don't mind, I would like to read a public tweet of yours from 2019. In it, you said, and I quote, "This week, my family recalls the anniversary of the 1980 execution of my grandmother, an outspoken teacher aligned with the FMLN, shot point blank in the head by the Salvadorian National Guard in our quiet neighborhood in the department of Usulutan. Would you," end quote, "would you mind telling our audience a little bit about this tragic part of your life?"
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, a lot of people ask me how I came into, or people just ask in general, how everyone comes into revolutionary politics or socialism or, you know, the sort of thing in Latin America. And of course, for us, for my family, it was just, you know, my family is from the FMLN, particularly, you know, both of my parents and both sides of the family. And my mom was a guerrilla combatant. And this is essentially a long story how my parents met and came together. And so, you know, through their stories of the war in El Salvador and the stories of, you know, other family members and friends, you know, I got to learn a whole lot about that. And I think that when I was really young, especially growing up where I grew up, you know, a lot of Latinos in the US live in places like Los Angeles, Miami, New York, as you know, and other places in the Northeast. And I did not live in a place where there are a lot of Latin Americans, and there weren't any Central Americans, and there weren't any Salvadorans. So I had never even met any besides the ones in my immediate family. And so there's no Chileans or anyone else either, right? So these are kind of stories that it was just, I always thought that, you know, my family is very particular. You know, there's a lot of people in the U.S. who were very, at the time when I was growing up, people were much more conservative, closed-minded. My parents were the opposite. My family was very open-minded in terms of social issues, very progressive. And of course, I knew a lot about different international events, different countries. They understood things about wars that were taking place in the Middle East and other places. And, you know, I kind of thought maybe it's just the result of, they're just people who read a lot. They're just people who, you know, watch a lot of news. They listen to a lot of talk radio. But of course, it's because of their political formation. And this is something I learned later on. It's because of their ability to understand and place, you know, the different events that they experienced and the different things that they see on the news within a wider context. And that's so important. And, you know, the older I got and as I was able to travel, I met people from, you know, South America. And to hear, you know, I came to hear about that these very similar events took place to varying degrees in places like Uruguay, Argentina, Chile, here in Bolivia as well. And so that kind of, you know, just kind of pulled it all together for me. And so, yeah, this, unfortunately, when my mom was quite young, this, you know, what I said in the tweet, that my grandmother was executed. And this is just one of many very difficult experiences my family, but many other families experienced, which is, you know, the killing of innocents, the disappearances of completely innocent people because of their, because they either were or were suspected to be aligned with the leftist forces in the country during that time. And so, you know, it takes, you know, as a lot of people in the diaspora know, it takes almost a lifetime. It takes years and years to understand what you're coming from. Of course, people live with a lot of trauma and they don't understand what they have lived through. That has been specifically the case, as you may know, with Salvadorans who've migrated to the exterior, have had a lot of times a difficult time grappling with the high levels of violence that people witnessed or experienced firsthand, and political incarceration, which my family experienced for years, and torture and other things like that. And so, of course, how I have applied this in my work is, you know, I am not really big on like titles or you know, trying to aggrandize myself. Like in a lot of ways, I just call myself like a press worker, a media worker, and call myself a journalist. I only do it because it makes more sense to use the term. It's like a term that people understand. But I've also never called myself a human rights activist. This is a word that a lot of people who use the word human rights activist are from the NGO sector, are, you know, liberals in terms of their ideology. But I have applied, you know, what I've learned from my family and from the history of El Salvador and the period of dictatorships and extrajudicial executions and disappearances and torture to what I've reported on here in Latin America now and the human rights situation in Latin America now, specifically, you know, in recent years that people have followed, is my reporting on the massacres that were carried out by the Jean Añez regime during the coup in November of 2019, and how just critically important it is to document every single detail of what took place there against the almost all completely 100% indigenous, you know, social movement people from humble neighborhoods, and areas of Bolivia, union members who were resisting the coup. And it's absolutely important that even though we, you know, were able to, the masses was able to take power once again following the latest elections, that there's still a lot of people who haven't received an ounce of justice for the things that happened to them just 2 years ago. And so this is something that, you know, this process exists in every country, but it's extremely important that these mass murderers, these human rights abusers who've committed crimes against humanity be brought to justice. And this is part of our work. It absolutely will not be accomplished without, you know, some documentation, without raising the profile of these crimes that were committed. Even though, you know, some people were able to return from exile, be released from jail, a lot of harm has been done. A lot of families have suffered a lot. And so that's how I've applied it in my work.
Mm-hmm. I think that, I commend you for your courage to, you know, express those views and insights into your own story. And I think it's also important to share that information because we are a part of history. We are part of Latin American history. We're part of the global North's often quite atrocious record of interventions in Latin America. And I think it's important for people to put a human face on those interventions and be aware that, you know, you might be living next to someone who has a very interesting and at times traumatic story that fits into a much wider picture that continues very much until the present day. Camila, finally, what's occurring in the near future for you in terms of your work as a journalist? I understand that the current media organization that you're working with is growing quite rapidly. What interesting projects are you working on, and what do you think we should be paying attention to in terms of wider trends in Bolivia and in Latin America?
Absolutely. Well, this weekend we'll be following Peru and in the days that follow to see what happens with this very important presidential election. There's a lot on the line, of course, and we wanted to be there on the ground, but the reason we're not is simply because, we don't have mountains of funding. We hope to receive, you know, a bit more support in the future, but because of COVID and the restrictions here in Latin America, a lot of things have actually closed down. So we had a lot of intentions to report on the ground in different places, and a lot of flights have been kind of, or routes have been scaled back, not necessarily suspended like in the first wave of COVID here in South America, but there's a lot less opportunity to travel. So we will be keeping track of things from here. We will be on the ground in Nicaragua. That's all I can really say, that we're following it very closely and that we will be there during the election and before quite soon. And so this is extremely important to us. It is the case that, you know, once again, as in Bolivia, as in Venezuela, there's a very fragmented opposition there, but it's still an opposition that has had a lot of support from the, you know, U.S. State Department and its agencies, a lot of financing. And this is specifically something that the Nicaraguan government is trying to deal with head on right now. Ben Norton of the Gray Zone has specifically done a lot of really important reporting on that. And in terms of what the imperialist attacks have been from the United States, the Alliance for Social Justice specifically has put out a lot of information about the new sanctions that the United States is preparing for Nicaragua in time for these elections that will be taking place in November of this year. So we think it's extremely important to tell the story of what happens there as it takes place. Nicaragua is a country where the campesino movement has been extremely important in producing its own, you know, its own food in order to not have to import things. This is just a huge part of any revolutionary process or any country that wants to be sovereign and independent. and sustainable. Is this, empowering the sectors to produce things for its own internal consumption, as well as to be able to export. And this is, the campesino movements is something that we want to specifically cover in Nicaragua. Having experienced and seen, the perspective primarily of the Cocalero movement here in Bolivia, where we're based, where of course the small low-income farmers also, in addition to coca, produce produce and other products. So we want to kind of learn from the experience of Nicaraguans as well in the countryside and follow the developments there as the electoral calendar unfolds. We will also be, of course, following everything that takes place in Venezuela, which will be holding its own regional elections in late November this year as well. And of course, once again, the electoral authorities, there are new electoral authorities, and the question will be to what extent, to what degree will the opposition and which opposition, which personalities, figures will choose to participate in these elections. But I mean, the case is obviously, as we all know, that everyone is waiting to see what was going to happen with the parliamentary elections that took place on December the 6th. And then early December, and then was installed at the beginning of January. That, of course, meant that the old National Assembly is gone. Juan Guaido doesn't lead any National Assembly. He's no type of opposition leader. He's no type of parliamentarian or lawmaker. He's literally just a guy. And for that reason, we've seen muted or scaled back support, if not the complete disappearance of support for Juan Guaido and that coup project. So we'll be continuing to follow that here in Bolivia. So many different things, but I think one of the most important and interesting things that we've been trying to cover here is, of course, that ALBA has had renewed energy, ALBA TCP. And of course, the Secretary General of ALBA is now Sacha Llorente, which is, he was a former UN ambassador of Bolivia. Under the Evo government. And so now he's also doing this very important role as the secretary of the executive secretary of ALBA. And they're also trying to revive kind of ALBA movimientos. They're going to be having a big social movement gathering, notwithstanding any issues that might arise with COVID, of course, a big gathering here in Bolivia. And they'll be trying to use, the UNASUR headquarters here in the Department of Cochabamba for a number of very interesting and important, Latin American events. And so I think this is really important that, we have this big, continental articulation that is once again being sparked that includes leftist parties, some parties which are in government, but also social movements in countries that are currently ran by neoliberal forces right now. But the organizing is taking place and articulation is taking place despite that. And so it's very interesting now that Evo Morales is not no longer in the government in any form. He is the president and leader of the Movement Towards Socialism, the party, as well as the leader of the Union Federation, which is the federation that owns our outlet. And so in his position as a social and political leader, but not a politician anymore, he's able to do more work with other social movements from other countries and kind of help build these links between our neighbors in Ecuador and Peru and bring everyone here to Bolivia and, of course, strengthen ties with the Venezuelan people, movements, and government as well. So this is something extremely interesting where Bolivia will be at the center and why it's so important for us to be based here, even though we will, to the extent possible, be traveling. To report throughout Latin America. Mm-hmm.
Camila Escalante. She is a journalist for Quechuan News based in the tropics of Cochabamba, Bolivia. Camila, thank you very much for speaking to us here at Indestructible Podcast, Indestructible Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy that you have this new platform to be able to have these conversations. It was an absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much.
That concludes the fifth episode of Indestructible. As always, I would like to thank Alborada for this opportunity to host Indestructible, Indestructible, and I would encourage our listeners to support this podcast on Patreon. You can do this for as little as the price of one cup of coffee a month. My sincere thanks, as always, go to Alborada's founder and co-editor, Pablo Navarrete, who produces this podcast. If you have any feedback on this episode, I would recommend you write to us on our email, which you will find on the website. Soon, we'll be back with episode 6, but until then, goodbye and stay safe.